Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Mayors, COVID is reaching crisis levels, by Caitlin Randall. As local coronavirus cases spike and Midland Memorial Hospital opens an additional COVID-19 wing to accommodate the higher numbers of patients, Midland Mayor Patrick Payton and Odessa Mayor David Turner implored the community to wear masks, but stopped short of saying they would enforce a mandate. Payton and Turner held a joint press conference Tuesday afternoon to address the crisis levels of local coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. During their remarks, they advocated for residents taking personal responsibility in mitigating the spread of COVID-19, as both mayors have stressed throughout the pandemic. If we do not get these numbers down, we will be forced to reduce occupancy to 50% or less, Payton said. These issues are going to come down from the state, and I think I know us well enough to know we do not want to be told what to do at the state level. So we're going to have to take care of it locally, or start shutting things down again against all of the will of every single one of us. The mayors said they would not enforce Governor Greg Abbott's statewide mask order because they don't think local law enforcement could or should be enforcing it. They also encouraged residents to be careful about gathering for Thanksgiving. Midland Memorial Hospital CEO Russell Myers reported Tuesday morning that the hospital has nearly 80 coronavirus patients, an all-time high, 27 patients in critical care, and 22 on ventilators. Myers said he was more worried than ever as the hospital prepared to move COVID-19 patients to the recently completed ninth floor after nearly reaching capacity in its current coronavirus ward. Chief Nursing Officer Kit Bredemus spoke before the Midland City Council on Monday about the state of the coronavirus in the community and residents' reluctance to wear masks, saying, we are at the mercy of those who choose not to take responsibility. Encouraging responsibility is not working. Bredemus appeared to tell the council he supported a mask mandate. The hospital is doing all it can at this point, and the only thing that's going to change the trajectory of this outbreak are the attitudes and behaviors of our city and this council, he said. I am asking all of you to come out with a full-throat endorsement of the governor's executive order for minimum standard health protocols, including required use of masks. When asked about Bredemus's remarks during Tuesday's press conference, Payton said he did not interpret Bredemus's statement to mean he supported a mask mandate, but rather that he wanted the council to enforce the message that residents should wear masks. This article is entitled, Myers Addresses Crisis Conditions at Middle Memorial Hospital, by Stuart Doreen. After being asked how worried he is about the latest coronavirus spike at Middle, all Midland Health CEO Russell Myers could do was let out a laugh like a man who's seen it all. Myers had just rattled off statistics that indicated Midland Memorial Hospital is impacted by the COVID-19 like no other time during the pandemic. The largest number of patients at any one time, nearly 80. 27 patients in critical care and 22 on ventilators. An occupancy rate of hospital beds currently at around 30%. A record 923 people tested last week and more than 30% of those testing positive. It feels much more like a community-wide crisis than the first two times, Myers said. So I'm more worried now than ever. It appears there is some relief as some COVID-19 patients will be moved onto the recently completed ninth floor, which will be home to mostly COVID-19 patients and open up other space for surgery and outpatient treatment. Myers said the seven-day rolling average at Midland Memorial shows COVID-19 patients have made up 28% of the total number of patients. Myers said the percentages are higher in Amarillo and Lubbock, and El Paso has a percentage around 41. Myers didn't mince words when he was asked how the staff is holding up. He said even with the help of the state, his team is stretched very thin. He called the current situation a crisis point where the hospital is stretching resources as much as we can to care for the people in front of us. So there may be times when our level of service suffers a little bit, Myers said. We've been contemplating a variety of creative ways of maximizing our ability to care for patients. And in some cases, in some places, that means asking our nurses to do more than we normally would. So we don't want to do that. But it's a matter of serving those patients who were very sick and right here in front of us. And we have nowhere else to go. So our team is stepping up and handling this as best as they can. But it is certainly taxing their capabilities. Myers has been the most consistent of Midland's officials representing a taxing entity when talking about COVID-19 as a threat to the community. While others have offered mixed messages about the community's approach to the disease, including the wearing of masks, Myers and Dr. Larry Wilson, Chief Medical Officer for Midland Health, have erred on the side of making sure Midlanders had the statistics and not partisan language. On Tuesday, Myers again provided a warning to those who still might not believe that COVID-19 is highly contagious. That's been readily apparent for a while now, and it's still as true as it ever was, he said. Myers also said that the city provided Midland Health with $100,000 in CARES funding to expand testing. He also said there is progress when it comes to antibody treatment, and he mentioned the vaccine news that came out Monday regarding Pfizer. In the longer term, there's reason for hope, Myers said. And we choose to hold out that hope and be prepared. This article is entitled MISD Election. Galindo, calling for District 1 recount would be wrong. Editor's note, the Reporter Telegram will follow up with insider coverage from the board meeting at MRT.com on Wednesday and in Thursday's edition. That will include what county officials told Midland ISD about the status of their investigation. By Stuart Doreen. Matt Galindo, a candidate for school board in East Midland, said Tuesday that he will not contest the November 3rd election for MISD School Board, Precinct 1. He also will not ask for a recount, despite missing out on a runoff by 4 votes. Galindo told the school board that the idea of paying $20,000 or more to contest an election and fix a mistake that never should have happened is outrageous. Galindo then said that it would not be right to ask for a recount in an election in which so many voters, possibly as many as 441 in districts 1 and 2, were essentially given incorrect ballots, and therefore the results of a recount would be from a voting contingent not representative of the entire district. He said he has challenged school board members to do right and do better. He said that was his message on the campaign trail, and to make a runoff in an election where taxpayers were left on the outside looking in doesn't sit right with him. This is so much more than winning the seat, Galindo said. This is about doing right and doing good. This appears to allow the board election process to move forward with runoffs. An official with the Secretary of State's office told the school board Tuesday that only the candidate and not the board or a resident could contest an election. Today's special meeting of the school board was about canvassing the November 3rd elections and calling the runoffs that are scheduled for December 15th. Board President Rick Davis read that Robert Marquez in District 2, South and Southeast Midland, and Brian Murray in District 7, Northwest Midland, captured enough votes to win their races outright. He also read the vote totals that showed runoffs will take place in District 1 between James Fuller and Michael Booker, and District 4, Steve Vargas and Katie Joyner. 2 weeks of early voting will start on November 30th. Midland County Elections Administrator Carolyn Graves provided board members with an update on the investigation into how people had been assigned to the wrong precincts. She told the board that an investigation is underway to identify and fix the problems in District 1. Then election officials will look at District 4 to make sure those precincts are correct. She again confirmed that the Midland ISD precincts were not updated after the redistricting at the beginning of the previous decade. She said once Districts 1 and 4 are updated, other districts will be investigated and updated. It was just human error, said Graves, who has been elections administrator for less than a year. The only thing I can tell you is it will be fixed.
The school board also heard from an official with the Texas Secretary of State's office who told the board that canvassing the vote is not a certification of the results, but a ministerial duty to accept results. The board wanted to hear from the Secretary of State's office, especially after the controversy that followed canvassing the results from the 2019 bond election. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled, Parents, Kids Show Support for MISD Teachers and Virtual Fridays, by J.C. Lewis. About 20 parents, children, and Midland ISD staff members gathered for a rally Tuesday evening outside of the MISD administration building to show support for the teachers who are having to return to in-person classes on Fridays. Megan and David Cannon made the rally a family event with their children. "We feel like the teachers aren't being heard and there are decisions being made without them being present," Megan said. "They are overworked, and I realize that a lot of us are having a hard time with this transition. But as things are spiking, now is not the time to force them all back in." Angelica Monclova, the head band director at San Jacinto Junior High School, said she didn't attend the rally on Friday because she worked over the lunch hour. "My sign says elective teacher equals 13 Google Classrooms," she said. "I'm teaching both online and in person. Just on my end, we are drowning in the amount of work that's required of us. So taking the Fridays away from us will be hard. As it is, Friday we get there early and leave late. We're grading, lesson planning, communicating to parents, we're making phone calls and emails, and this is with Fridays off." Christy Taylor, the assistant band director at San Jacinto, said a survey was sent out to teachers about whether or not they supported the online Fridays and if they wanted to continue doing that. She said 96.3% of teachers who responded to the survey said they wanted to keep the online Fridays. Rally organizer Summer Romero, who has several children in MISD, said a petition called Respect and Protect Teachers was started Monday on change.org. It had about 300 signatures as of Tuesday evening, she said. It was a group of concerned parents who found out about the teacher get-together on Friday and wished we had been aware of it so we could have come in support and solidarity, Romero said. "This petition was a showing of what else we could do to support and let them know that we are here, we are listening. We want to give them whatever tools they need to be successful, as well as keep them safe and keep students safe." She said they will be presenting the petition to the school board once they get more signatures. While the group stood outside of the administrative building, the school board met on the sixth floor. "I support the teachers also, but the students' education is the priority," said Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon after the meeting. "Teachers brought things to my attention that I will address immediately." This article is entitled, County Judge May Call for Health Assessment Tools Return, by Stuart Doreen. Midland County Judge Terry Johnson said Tuesday that he may bring the Midland County Health Assessment Tool, called CHAT, for another spin. Johnson said the Commissioner's Court authorized it for 90 days during the spring, and the tool was predicting some spikes when the county got to the end of that 90-day period. CHAT is a program that Johnson and former City Councilman John James worked together on and brought before county leaders. It requires the community to log in and input certain information, including health information, and then provides data to gauge the health of the people in that area. County leaders approved spending no more than $15,000 with James on the program. Johnson also partnered with James on a county planning session. "It's something I'd have to take to court in 2 weeks," Johnson said Tuesday. "I believe I'll take it back and see." This is the coronavirus page. This article is entitled, City Reports 151 New Coronavirus Cases, from Staff Reports. The Midland Health Department has completed a case contacting for COVID-19 positives received on November 2nd. There are 151 new cases, according to the city's spokeswoman. These new cases bring the overall case count to 6,213. There are 2,135 active cases and 3,705 people have recovered, it was reported on Tuesday. During the pandemic, there have been 103 COVID-19 related deaths. Because of the number of cases received each day, the health department is 6 days behind in contacting positive cases and contacts. Staff currently is working on cases from November 3rd, according to the press release.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, November 11, 2020. Salute to veterans. Anita Germertsfelder, director of the Midland Education Foundation, speaks with Ramon Armendariz, a retired Marine Corps major, at Midland ISD's Veterans Day show on November 11, 2019, at Bowie Fine Arts Academy. Today is Veterans Day, intended to honor and thank all military personnel who served the United States in all wars. The holiday began as Armistice Day to commemorate the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, when an armistice between Germany and the Allied nations came into effect, according to timeanddate.com. Armistice Day was commemorated for the first time on November 11, 1919. Beginning in 1954, November 11 became a day to honor all veterans. City cancels Christmas events. The annual Christmas tree lighting ceremony and Christmas parade have been canceled, the city spokeswoman said Monday. The tree will be set up in Centennial Park and will be lit on December 1, she said. MISD public meetings continue. Public meetings continue today for residents to provide feedback on the upcoming superintendent search. The meetings are 11:30 a.m. at Bowie Fine Arts Academy Auditorium and 5:30 p.m. at the Midland High School Library. Restaurants to treat veterans, active duty personnel. Bubba's 33 locations in Midland and Odessa will be continuing their tradition of treating veterans and active military personnel to a free lunch on Veterans Day. Those who aren't able to attend in person today may receive a voucher that will be good through June 30, 2021. Lunch is served 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. The vouchers will be distributed today at a tent in the restaurant's parking lot. Dickie's Barbecue Pit is offering a free classic sandwich and a side for military service members, in-store or online, with a $10 minimum purchase on Veterans Day. When ordering online, use the code VETFREE, according to a press release. Cotton Patch Cafe is offering a free chicken fried steak or chicken fried chicken meal for veterans or active military on Veterans Day. No purchase is required. The offer is valid today with proof of military service. The restaurant also will give a commemorative American flag pin to all veterans and active military personnel. Synergy offers tickets for food. Synergy Cinemas and Entertainment is offering one free movie ticket with a donation of two canned food items for a local food pantry. Patrons can get the free tickets through Sunday, according to a press release from Synergy. Texas Recycles Day is Saturday. Annual Texas Recycles Day is 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday at Chaparral Center parking lot. Items that can be brought for recycling are electronics, appliances, and tires. In addition, up to 3 boxes of paper can be brought for free shredding. For more information, call Keep Midland Beautiful at 688-7745 or visit keepmidlandbeautiful.org. Today in history. Today's Wednesday, November 11, the 316th day of 2020. There are 50 days left in the year. Today is Veterans Day. Today's highlight. On November 11, 1918, fighting in World War I ended as the Allies and Germany signed an armistice in the forest of Compiègne.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Joe Biden Can Save Nation from the Precipice, by Kathleen Parker, Washington Post Writers Group. Joe Biden may have won the presidency, but Democrats plainly lost the election. The blue tsunami predicted by some pundits and pollsters turned out to be a shallow baby wave of tepid water. The anticipated mandate was little more than a list of spoiled hopes and dreams that liberalism would finally have its day in America. Landslide is still just a song. The United States is a center-right nation, which people living outside the Washington, New York, West Coast bubbles have always known. Trump won in 2016, in part by making average Americans feel like he understood them. The smarter members of the House Democratic Caucus get this, but most have kept quiet in deference to groupthink and the fear of being primaried by their own left flank. Several caucus members began complaining about some of the unhelpful lefty messages as the votes were telling the broader story. Former Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri might have erred in uttering the truth when, speaking as an MSNBC contributor Thursday, she said Democrats had left Middle America behind by focusing too much on cultural issues and identity politics removed from the concerns of the mainstream. As we circled those issues, we left some voters behind, and Republicans dove in, McCaskill told MSNBC's Brian Williams. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York, ripped McCaskill for her remark, tweeting, "Why do we listen to people who lost elections as if they are expert in winning elections?" McCaskill lost her Senate seat to Senator Josh Hawley in 2018, but she didn't lose her common sense. There's a rather substantial number of Americans, meanwhile, who wonder why anyone listens to Ocasio-Cortez. Donald Trump's apparent near win, combined with Republican gains in the House and in state legislatures, tells us all we need to know about where the country stands. If Trump hadn't acted as his own worst enemy during the campaign, it might have been his landslide to claim. But Trump couldn't pretend to be an adult long enough to assuage fears that his impulsive nature might ruin us. Democrats and their media cheerleaders were shocked by Trump's support among blacks and Hispanics. In Texas and Florida, Trump won 4 of every 10 Hispanic voters and perhaps a bit more. He performed better in many red states than he had in 2016. He even improved as a percentage of the vote in the number of blue states that he lost 4 years ago. Very few votes will separate this loss from a win. Among other lessons, it may be time for Democrats to realize that blacks and Hispanics are no more monolithic than any other group of voters. Most black voters for Trump were male. 52% of black men who identified as conservative voted for the president. 1 in 3 black men in the Midwest marked their ballots for the incumbent. Robert L. Johnson, co-founder of Black Entertainment Television, explained his view of black votes for Trump. "I think black Americans are getting a little bit tired of delivering huge votes for the Democrats and seeing minimal return in terms of economic wealth and closing the wealth gap, job creation, and job opportunities," he told CNBC on the day after the election. But it was also black voters who, in the end, helped to deliver so much of the vote that elected Biden president. Ultimately, Biden's slim victory will be a gift to the country. There's no reason that Biden can't be a great president. He doesn't have to serve the left that America has rejected. He can make his stand and his legacy as the president who brought the nation back from the precipice. A one-term president, beholden to no one, he can say there will be no stacking the Supreme Court, no end to the filibuster, no Green New Deal as written, no single-payer health insurance, and so on down the liberal wish list. Biden is easy to like, knows the ropes, has friends on both sides of the aisle, can broker a deal, raise the level of discourse, restore dignity to the White House. All those things we've missed the past 4 years. After his third run for president, he has the rare opportunity to go down in history as a good man and the most consequential of presidents. His humility would be a gift to us all. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, "Biden Rides into Office on Blue Trickle, Not on a Blue Wave," by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Ordinarily, it's not possible for a party to win the presidency and have a bad election night. But the Democrats managed it. Pending the outcome of two Senate runoffs in Georgia, Joe Biden looks set to become a caretaker president who won't be consigning any legislation that doesn't pass muster in Mitch McConnell's Senate first. He isn't riding into the White House on the strength of a blue wave, as was so often predicted, but a blue trickle that saw Democrats fail to win control of the Senate. They need to win both Georgia seats in January to get a 50-50 tie, suffer shocking setbacks in the House, and lose ground in state legislative races after investing heavily in them. Biden clearly owes his victory, which President Donald Trump, of course, is still contesting, in large part to Trump's personal unpopularity. In races where the president wasn't on the ballot, in contrast, the weakness of the Democratic Party stood exposed, and it paid the price. If the former vice president succeeded in making the presidential race a referendum on Trump, Republicans succeeded in making House races, in effect, a referendum on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the woke socialism that animates Democratic activists and draws so much attention. Nancy Pelosi posed for a cover of Rolling Stone with members of the Squad, and Ocasio-Cortez is on the cover of the latest issue of Vanity Fair. Bolstered by the media, Democrats were so certain that they were riding the tide of history to inevitable pickups in the House that they didn't pause to take note of the unpopularity of their agenda and the left of their party. Republicans took the socialist label and hung it around the neck of Democrats. It was especially devastating in South Florida, where voters from Cuba, Venezuela, and Colombia came to the United States to flee socialism and have no interest in voting for anyone whose party includes outright socialists. Republicans knocked out incumbent Democratic Representatives Donna Shalala and Debbie Mercosell Powell in heavily Hispanic districts. In New York, Republicans used the most idiotic slogan of our times, defund the police, and the state's law curtailing cash bail to pummel Democrats on law and order and likely defeat two House incumbents. The GOP wielded the Democrats' anti-fossil fuel agenda in the Southwest and Biden's tax increase in California to defend their seats and make pickups across the map. When all is said and done, Nancy Pelosi's House majority may be the smallest in 20 years and certainly will be highly vulnerable in 2022. There has been Democratic backbiting where there was supposed to be celebration. Virginia moderate Representative Abigail Spanberger, who barely won her re-election bid, loosed a profanity-laced tirade against the party's left during a House Democratic conference call, outraged that it had handed Republicans so much ammunition. On the other hand, if Biden is indeed hamstrung by a Republican majority in the Senate, the left will be disappointed and angry with his administration from the outset. It is usually the losing side that is beset by a bitter civil war after an election. Make no mistake, there is plenty of that to come in the Republican Party. But despite winning the White House, the Democrats will be riven by recriminations and fights over the path ahead. It is always a danger for a political party to believe its own PR. That's a risk especially hard for Democrats to avoid when practically every instrument of the culture celebrates left-wing causes and works to create the sense that their triumph is inexorable. This year, Democrats thought they were marching from strength to strength, when they were really on thin ice with an electorate that was prepared to reject Trump, but not to empower a party that has elevated socialists and outlandish ideas from defunding the police to the Green New Deal. This column is entitled Stay the Course Until Vaccine is Available by Megan McArdle, Washington Post Writers Group. The sky suddenly seems bluer, the sun a little brighter, the chirping of the birds outside my window a little more joyous. Pfizer and its partner, BioNTech, have announced that preliminary tests of its vaccine show it to be more than 90% effective at preventing infection with the novel coronavirus. If you're wondering what to make of that, here are some preliminary thoughts from someone who has been writing about COVID-19 since March, and writing about pharmaceutical development much longer. These results are indeed preliminary. All we, the public, have so far is a news release. The data will need to be scrutinized by the Food and Drug Administration and more data collected before we know for sure how good this is. Even if this vaccine confers strong immunity, we can't yet know how long it will last. Nor are any pharmaceutical studies ever big enough to detect really rare 1-in-a-million side effects. All that said, if the early data pans out, this is very, very good news. The side effect profile looks pretty minimal, and its efficacy is fantastic. The FDA's minimum target for a COVID-19 vaccine was 50% efficacy at preventing infection, about what you get from a decent flu vaccine. At 90%, you're closer to the measles vaccine, something that can, with mass inoculation, effectively eliminate the disease in the population. Keep in mind, however, that mass inoculation will be a massive headache. Earlier vaccination programs against childhood illnesses could rely on widespread immunity among adults and focus narrowly on kids or adults who hadn't had the disease. Once we have an effective vaccine, we'd ideally want to inoculate most of the population in short order. That will be particularly challenging with this vaccine, which needs to be stored at minus 94 degrees. You can't just pop this one in the fridge. But worth the hassle. Assuming this vaccine keeps people from getting infected, rather than just making the infection milder, each additional vaccination contributes to herd immunity and helps us save the lives of people whose immune systems aren't working well enough to make use of the vaccine. But given how politicized the COVID-19 response has become in the United States, that's going to be a challenge. We should start by making it clear to people that while this was a land speed record for vaccine development, the speed has come from throwing more resources toward the process and running trials in parallel, not from skimping on testing or fudging approval standards. Even if we solve the storage and trust problems, it will take a while to reach mass inoculation. Pfizer estimates it can produce 50 million doses globally in 2020 and up to 1.3 billion in 2021, which isn't enough for everyone who will want it. So let's hope there are more and equally effective vaccines in the work from other manufacturers. In the meantime, we'll probably start by targeting healthcare workers and the elderly. Luckily, this is not just good news for Pfizer, but for the other vaccine makers and candidates as well, since all of them are targeting the same viral spike protein that helps it enter your cells. This suggests that approach can work if we give it time to bear fruit. The delay between announcement, approval, and wide vaccine availability will be hard to wait out. Should a vaccine be approved but remain in limited supply, it will taunt us as we settle into the darkest days of winter with our masks, our hand sanitizer, and what's left of our sanity. People will be tempted to return to normal early. Don't give in to that temptation. If you take only one thing away from this column, I want you to remember this. The expected value of COVID-19 prevention has never been higher. The argument that all the precautions were unsustainable, so we might as well just all get it now, were unfortunately persuasive if a vaccine was 5 years away. If it's 5 or 6 months away, however, it's worth staying the course, or maybe even increasing your vigilance a little to avoid a substantial risk of death or lifetime disability. Which brings me to my final thought. Whatever we have suffered in the past 8 months, and whatever we are suffering now, we have been witnesses to a miracle. Miracle. At no time before in human history would it have been possible to slow the spread of a novel disease collectively, much less to hope for a vaccine so shortly after the emergence of the virus. Our ancestors could never have afforded to focus so much of humanity's efforts on the same problem and at the same time. Nor would they have had the scientific expertise they noted to manage it. However miserable this pandemic has been, those of us who are still surviving it should remember that we are damn lucky to be alive right now, in every sense of those words.
This is the obituary column, Wednesday, November 11th. Dorothy Jean Carlson Arthur Sanders. Dorothy Jean Carlson Arthur Sanders was born December 22, 1930, in Fort Worth, Texas. She was the fourth of four children. Dorothy was preceded in death by her parents, C.E. and Margaret Carlson Sr., her siblings, and her first husband, J.B. Arthur. Dorothy married J.B. Arthur on June 16, 1953, and he passed away on December 11, 1973. On April 17, 1976, Dorothy married William Lloyd Sanders in Midland, Texas, and he passed away on June 11, 2019. Together, Dorothy and Lloyd have six children: Kelly Arthur Childress Box, Kay Arthur O'Brien, Mike, Diana Sanders Downey, Daryl, Brent Allen Sanders, Candace, Brian Williams Sanders, and Jimmy Brian Arthur, Cindy. Their family includes 10 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren. Friends are welcome to pay their respects from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Wednesday, November 11th at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home in Midland. Graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, November 12th at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Heriberta Dominguez Silva. Our beloved mother entered her heavenly home on Sunday, November 8, 2020. Heriberta Dominguez Silva was born in San Juan, Ojinaga, Chihuahua, Mexico on March 25, 1943, the daughter of Pomposo and Marta Dominguez. Heriberta was married to the late Concepcion Flores Silva for 61 years. Heriberta will be remembered by her daughters, Lila Montoya and husband Fermin Montoya, Carmen S. Zubia and husband Santiago Zubia, Martha Berzosa and husband Rodney Berzosa, Manuela Piercy and her husband Marty Piercy, Maribel Lowe and husband Kenny Lowe, sons Santos Silva, Jesus Carlos Silva and wife Josie Silva, Abelino Silva and wife Belinda Silva, 26 grandchildren and 38 grandchildren. Her sisters Nicolasa Hasso, Ernestina Zubia, brothers Zaragoza Dominguez, Erasmo Dominguez, Aldegundo Dominguez, Solomon Dominguez. Heriberta went to join her late husband Concepcion Flores Silva, daughter Isabel Silva and brother Jose Maria Dominguez. Visitation will be held Wednesday, November 11th at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, 1502 North La Mesa Road, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., with rosary beginning at 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will be held Thursday at 11 a.m., November 12th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church, 4601 Neely Avenue. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Ray David Guillermo. Ray David Guillermo, 59, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Saturday, November 7th. The family will receive friends for visitation from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. at the branch at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home on Wednesday, November 11th, and a prayer service at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, November 11th. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, November 12th at the branch at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. David was born on December 29, 1960 in Santa Cruz, Tepexpan, Estado de Mexico, Mexico. He immigrated to the U.S. in the 1970s to Fort Stockton, where he learned to work and take any job available. From there, he made his way to Midland in 1981. Here, he met the love of his life, Clara L. Gamboa, married her in 1982, and they lived together almost inseparable for 38 years. David is lovingly remembered by his wife, Clara Guillermo, his four children, Stephanie Barella,
Ray David Guillermo Jr., Christy Guillermo, Jose Carlos Guillermo, his five brothers and one sister, his 12 grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Truman Laro Woody Gregory. We are so very sad to say goodbye to our wonderful husband, father, grandfather, and friend, Truman Laro Woody Gregory of Odessa, Texas. Woody was born on June 29, 1933, to Lemuel and Eleanor Gregory and attended school in Wichita Falls. He married Betty Sue Story in 1952. Woody is preceded in death by his parents and six siblings, as well as his wife, Betty Gregory. He is survived by his beloved wife, Genevieve, who he married in 1992, son, Don Gregory, and his wife, Claire, daughter, Laura Fink, and her husband, Joel, and many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, November 12th at Crossroads Church, 6901 East Highway 191, Odessa, Texas. Contributions in memory of Woody may be made to the UTPB School of Engineering at UT Permian Basin. Attention Wendell Snodgrass, 4901 East University, Odessa, Texas, 79762. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Richard Preston Jack Chestnut. Richard Preston Jack Chestnut gained his angel wings on November 7, 2020. Richard was born on November 7, 2020, to Richard Chestnut and Alyssa Knowles in Odessa, Texas. He is survived by his parents, Richard Harold Chestnut and Alyssa Knowles, sister Rosalie Chestnut, grandparents Cassie Steele, Chris Knowles, J.T. and Deanna Chestnut, Jerry Downing, great-grandparents Shorty and Nadine Pepler, Nancy Keating, Thomas and Virginia Knowles, Jerry Wooten, Donnie and Janice Gray, Doug and Nancy Chestnut, along with various uncles, aunts, cousins, and family. He is preceded in death by one brother, Christopher Chestnut, and his uncle Alan, and great-great-mama Margaret. Funeral services will be on Wednesday, November 11th at 2 p.m. in the American Heritage Funeral Home with Mike Bartlett officiating. Burial will take place at American Heritage Cemetery. Death notices. Deanna Lynn D. Raschel. Deanna Lynn D. Raschel passed away on Sunday, November 8th in Midland, Texas. Visitation is on November 11th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel, followed by a celebration of life at 7 p.m. A graveside service and burial will be held at Ogden Cemetery in Winnsboro, Louisiana, on Saturday, November 14th at 2 p.m. She is survived by her mother, Shirley Raschel, her father, Neil Raschel, fiancé Larry Jackson, aunts, uncles, and cousins. Isaiah Soto. Isaiah Soto, 8 years old, of Midland, passed away on Sunday, November 8th. Family will receive friends from 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, November 11th at Mid-Cities Community Church, 191 Campus. Funeral services will be held at 3 p.m. Thursday, November 12th at Mid-Cities Community Church, 191 Campus. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Juan Manuel Favela. Juan Manuel Favela passed away on November 5th, 2020 in Midland, Texas. Juan was born on November 5th, 2020 to Ricardo and Eva Favela Urias in Midland. He is survived by his parents, Eva Favela and Ricardo Favela, seven sisters, and his maternal grandfather, Cruz Manuel Urias, paternal grandmother, Carlota Urias, paternal grandfather, Juan Favela, paternal grandmother, Maria Valdez, Aunt Jeanette Favela, Aunt Yesenia Villa, Aunt Josie Grimaldo, and Uncle Cruz A. Urias. Funeral services will be Thursday, November 12th at 12 p.m. in the American Heritage Funeral Home with Deacon Villa officiating. Burial will take place at American Heritage Cemetery. Kevin Taylor. Kevin Taylor, 55, of Midland, passed away November 9th. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, November 12th at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 12 p.m. Friday, November 13th at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. Court okays plan to help nonprofits. UA News at OAOA.com. Through its coronavirus relief funds, the Ector County Commissioner's Court on Tuesday approved funding for devices and hotspots for Ector County ISD and decided to divide up funds for nonprofits. Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons said there was a little more than $700,000 in potential CARES Act funding, so he suggested dividing it up among the four commissioners and county judge so they can take requests. The commissioners will take the recommendations next week and probably distribute checks a day or two after that, Simmons said. Simmons noted that many nonprofits have had to cancel their fundraisers due to the pandemic. Each commissioner and the judge would have about $140,000 to recommend for distribution. Simmons said they verified that nonprofits would qualify for these funds. Simmons said they verified that nonprofits would qualify for these funds and should contact their respective commissioners. He added that this still leaves $13,000 to $15,000 in case a department needs masks or overtime, for example. On a separate item, commissioners approved a resolution requesting that the state legislature modify Section 43.137 of the Texas Local Government Code to add misdemeanor and juvenile prosecution and child protective services cases to the jurisdiction of the district attorney's office. This modifies District Attorney-elect Dusty Gallivan's initial plan earlier this fall to combine the two offices into a criminal DA's office. Gallivan, who is currently the county attorney, has instead decided to ask the court to request the Texas legislature in Austin add misdemeanor and juveniles prosecutions and child protective service cases to the DA's jurisdiction, which have until now been the court attorney's responsibility. The court also approved providing $270,523 in CARES funding to ECISD for iPads, Chromebooks, and hotspots. Communications Officer Mike Adkins said this will help reimburse the district for these items. The City of Odessa also provided reimbursement funds recently. We are very thankful for the County Commissioner's support. Solving this issue of internet service for all students is going to take all of us working together, and this is an important step for us. Our kids are the big winners here, Adkins said in an email. In other business, the court accepted a $2,500 donation from the Fraternal Order of Police, Odessa Lodge No. 1, for the Ector County Sheriff's Office. Declared surplus and approved sales by auction of items. Approved taking actions on purchases made by the Public Works Department from R.B. Everett and Kirby Smith. Approved a 90-day burn ban. Renewed the fleet fuel card program. Approved overtime for two employees in lieu of comp time for the weekend of October 30th through 31st during an expected shortage of personnel due to the coronavirus pandemic. Approved a 2021 budget adjustment to the general fund, building maintenance, building materials, form unreserved fund balance for $59,770. The court will also meet at 2 p.m. Thursday in a special meeting to canvass and discuss the general election results. Veterans Day 2020. Thanks for your service. The caption reads, Buford Humphreys poses for a photo with his military retirement portrait last week in his home in Monahans. Humphreys was a United States Air Force veteran who fought in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War before retiring in 1971. Humphreys initially served as a squadron navigator in World War II before flying in B-29s during the Korean War and later C-130 cargo planes in the Vietnam War. Monahan's Vet Recalls Time in Three Wars by Michael Baer. Buford Humphreys is a veteran who had to respond to many calls to action for his country during his life. The longtime West Texas resident was a pilot in the United States Air Force and resides in Monahans, fought in three different wars, serving in World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. As he reflects on Veterans Day this year, he wants everyone to never forget the sacrifices that others made in defending this country. There was a time when Veterans Day was a big event, but nowadays it's another day of the month, Humphreys said. You got to remember all of those poor people who didn't survive. Can you imagine landing on one of the beaches on D-Day? Can you imagine the agony that must have gone on? Humphreys' time in the military started when the United States entered World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. His military career would last 29 years as he worked his way up to becoming a colonel in the Air Force, an achievement that was always a goal of his since joining the military. I'll put it this way, as far as I was concerned, I had been a success, Humphreys said as he reflected on his accomplishments. Now, I could have said I was looking to be a general, but I wasn't. I was happy to have made colonel, because there are many who didn't. During this time in the service, Humphreys flew in many different aircrafts, including B-24s during World War II, B-29s in the Korean War, and C-130 aircraft cargo airplanes during the Vietnam War, Humphreys said. During World War II, Humphreys served as a squadron navigator in the 392nd Bomb Squadron. In Korea, he was with the 19th Bomb Wing and during the Vietnam War commanded the 773 Troop Carrier Squadron. However, there was never a time where he and his other pilots weren't afraid during the wars. When there's a fighter plane shooting at you, you get pretty scared, Humphrey said. You may get hit and you may not. There are times when you get damn scared. When you got to the end of the mission, you wondered how many more you could survive. However, Humphreys, no matter what, was able to keep his composure during each mission. That was because of training, he said. That's what you were trained for. Anybody who said they were not scared is a big liar. Humphreys would go on to retire from the military in 1971. During this time in service, he was base commander at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. Even though he was born in the town of West, located 20 miles north of Waco, Humphreys spent most of his life, with the exception of his time serving overseas, in different parts of West Texas, including El Paso, Odessa, Monahans, and Littlefield, which is where he graduated from high school in 1939. He received his college education from the University of Texas at Austin, graduating in 1957 while he was still in the Air Force, and has lived in Monahans since 2010. He has four children, one son and three daughters, as well as four grandchildren, all of whom have no shortage of praise for his work in the military and his service to the country. We're very proud, especially with him going through three wars, Betty Turner, one of his daughters, said. The fact that he's such an American and a patriot means a lot. He was always there for the military and for America. His grandson, Craig Turner, also expressed his gratitude. I'm very proud of him and what he's accomplished and where he came from in East Texas to putting himself through a college to becoming a colonel, Craig said. It's no small feat that he accomplished in his life. I'm very proud of him as a grandson. He means a lot to me. The caption reads, Plaques and diplomas accent a painted portrait of Air Force veteran Buford Beau Humphreys in one of the rooms of his homes. Born in West Texas, Humphreys went on to enlist in the United States Air Force in 1941, following the attack on Pearl Harbor. During his service, Beau graduated from the University of Texas in 1957, achieved the rank of colonel, and served as a base commander at Whitmore Air Force Base in Missouri. Humphreys retired in 1971 and has been living in Monahans since 2010.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.